This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Network. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Network does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Advancing the Science on Addiction and Recovery, brought to you by the National Institute of Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institute of Health. I'm your host, Jimmy Alexander. Today, we have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Lorenzo Leggio, MD, PhD, who serves as the clinical director at NIDA IRP. Now, what is the NIDA IRP, doctor? Tell us what that is.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jimmy. First of all, thanks for having me here today. So NIDA stands for National Institute on Drug Abuse. It's one of the 27 institutes and centers of the National Institutes of Health here in Maryland. And precisely, NIDA does support research on drug addiction. Now, specific to IRP, IRP stands for Intramural Research Program. So that means that while NIDA, NIDA, supports primarily research around the country and around the world on addiction, there is a component of NIDA, the Intramural Research Program, where people like me, we do research in-house here in Maryland within the National Institute of Health.
Now, doctor, I know that you're a father and a lucky husband, as you said, but also you're a doctor who's been working on drug addiction, drug abuse, alcohol abuse for a very long time.
Yeah. Actually, I just became a father 4 months ago, so that's kind of new in my life.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And yes, I've been working this field since actually I was a medical student, and then I also pursued residency in internal medicine, a PhD. And so, yes, I've been working this field for 20 years, first in Italy, which is where I'm from, then at Brown University in Providence, and now here at the National Institute of Health here in Maryland.
Now, doctor, there are people who are listening, and they may say, well, I like to have a drink every once in a while. What is the difference between someone who likes to drink and somebody who has a drinking problem?
Right. That's a great question. So most of the people in our society drink some alcohol. Actually, in the past, there was even the belief that alcohol in moderation could be beneficial for your cardiovascular system, meaning for your blood pressure, for your heart. What we have been learning over time is actually that there is not such a safe amount of alcohol, but there is what we call low risk and high risk. The difference is that when people drink excessive amounts of alcohol, this may lead to problems related to our body. To give an example, alcohol is one, if not the leading cause of liver cirrhosis. So when the liver doesn't work any longer. And it's actually the leading cause of liver transplantation in the United States.
You know, I should tell you, doctor, my stepfather died of cirrhosis of the liver at 49 years old. And is not a pleasant way to go. And my heart goes out to anybody who's battling addiction or battling alcohol abuse, because it was brutal, as you well know.
Yeah.
Now, the research that you were doing at the National Institute of Health, NIDA, or NIDA, tell us how that's going and what are you really doing there?
Yeah, so the ultimate goal of our research is to better understand addiction. And as we try to better understand addiction, to develop new treatments for people with alcohol and substance use disorders, so people with addiction. And also part of our goal is to really understand which, for example, medications work best for specific patients. For example, my program in particular is very interested in developing new medications for alcohol use disorder. But that does not mean that we are going to identify one single medication that is going to work for everybody. So part of our goal is to do what we call in biomedical research precision medicine. So to understand which medication may work best for some patients and which medications may work best for other patients.
Now, why would you say, and now in 2024, have you noticed during your career that people are drinking more or less?
I think overall, it's safe to say that the people are drinking more. In particular, during the pandemic, we saw a very dramatic increase in the amount of alcohol consumed by the general U.S. population. We also saw more death due to alcohol, and we also saw more medical disease due to alcohol. For example, the number of liver disease due to alcohol has been increasing during the pandemic. Now, even before the pandemic, alcohol and the drugs of addiction were already leading reasons why people have a variety of medical problems and why they die. And with COVID, actually, things have been getting even worse. So we're really in the middle of a crisis in our society where addiction is really taking a lot of people away, including people we love, relatives, friends, etc.
Now, we hear addiction. I think we all know what an addiction is. But what is, would you say, the scientific description, definition of addiction?
You know, this is a great question. And believe it or not, not the entire scientific community will agree on one single definition. But I would say that in general, based on the science, based on the knowledge we have, we define addiction as a chronic brain disease. Chronic means that is kind of a long-term disease that the people need to battle and seek a treatment for. A brain disease because now we have, compared to, I would say, 10 or 20 years ago, we have a much better understanding of why some people develop and then why some people maintain addiction. Because many people do get exposure to addictive drugs, alcohol, cannabis, smoking, cocaine, opioids, etc. But not everybody will develop addiction. So now we have a better understanding of what is happening in the brain. Technically speaking, we know the neurocircuitry, so the mechanism, how and why people develop addiction due to some change in the brain. Now, that doesn't mean that we have a full understanding of addiction, but we definitely have a better understanding of addiction because of research that institutes like the NIDA, where I work, have done in the past decades. And as in a chronic brain disease, that means that addiction is a medical disease. So usually what I do emphasize a lot is that addiction is a medical disease, just like, for example, depression, Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's disease, hypertension, cancer, etc., etc. One gigantic problem we have in our society is actually stigma. So despite we know from science, from biomedical research, that addiction is a brain disease, is a medical disease, again, just like hypertension, diabetes, Parkinson's, etc., still we tend to marginalize people with addiction. We don't provide care as we should to people with addiction. If people with addiction do struggle a lot to speak up and say, I have a problem, I need help, I seek treatment. To give an idea, just as a comparison, 85% of people with diabetes receive medications for diabetes. But when you look at, for example, alcohol use disorder, only 2% of people with alcohol use disorder receive a medication, despite we have 3 medications approved by the FDA to treat alcohol use disorder. And one of the main reasons why we have this gigantic gap in our society is because the stigma plays a key role. There is the shame for people to say, I have an addiction problem. There is lack of training. When doing medical school, medical students and then the residents don't receive enough training on how to treat addiction.
Thank you, doctor. Coming up, you'll find out how you could participate in a clinical research. That's coming up next.
This episode of Advancing the Science on Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Welcome back to Advancing the Science on Addiction and Recovery, brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of NIH. Now, Dr. Allegio, NIH, you're helping people battle addiction, helping people conquer it. Why do people drink? Why do people do drugs, smoke cigarettes? What is it about those habits?
Yeah, this is a great question. And there's not just one answer. There are many reasons why people drink alcohol or use drugs and why some of this initial use may lead to misuse and then to addiction. One reason is actually related to novelty, the idea of seeking something new. Another reason is because some people feel particularly what we say rewarded, the pleasure of drinking, and that the rewarding feeling may lead the people to seek more and more alcohol or, for example, more and more cocaine. And then there are also reasons related to stress, to anxiety, to other medical disorders associated with addiction, such as depression and anxiety. So over time, some people may find that these drugs, such as alcohol, may reduce your stress, may reduce your anxiety. And at some point, this may come as sort of a vicious cycle where people have the feeling that, for example, by drinking alcohol, they may release their stress. They may feel less anxiety. They may sleep better. But actually, over time, alcohol and addictive drugs will make your anxiety worse, your stress worse, and your sleep worse. So as you can see, there is a constellation of reasons why people may develop this problematic alcohol or drug use and developing addiction. Now, it's also important to know, as we say before, that addiction is a medical disease. And there is a genetic component, which actually is very, very important. Based on the data we have, we believe that at least 50% is genetically driven. Now, that doesn't mean that just because, let's say, as an example, my father had an alcohol use disorder, I'm going to necessarily develop an alcohol use disorder, but that means I have a higher risk. But then there is another 50%, and that's what we call the environment, stressors, challenges in life. And all of us have different ways how we can cope with the challenge. Challenge could be a significant problem with your partner or in the family. It could be a job-related problem. It could be losing the job. It could be being a financial problematic situation, could be losing someone you really loved in life. And one way how some people may cope with that stress is by seeking a coping with the use of alcohol and drugs. So it really becomes a sort of gene by environment interaction. That's a little technical terminology, I understand, but that means that the interaction of your genetic makeup and the environment around may synergize to lead some people to develop addiction.
And there's got to be a way to break that cycle because, as you just mentioned, I mean, it can go generation to generation to generation and cause havoc in so many lives that come from all of those. Now, I know what the work that you guys are doing, that you have these clinical trials that you have, and kind of explain what is detailed in those.
Right. So we have actually many clinical trials at the NIDA Intramural Research Program. Actually, we are in Baltimore in Maryland. And so some clinical studies are designed to better understand addiction. So we enroll people with alcohol or substance use disorder, and we ask several questions. We draw their blood to test some biomarkers, such as markers of inflammation, etc. And we want to understand if the questions they tell us and the answers they give it to us, I should say, and what we see in their blood may help us to better understand why they develop addiction. We also use fMRI. So we basically look at the brain with the fMRI. And by doing so, we deep dive in understanding how the brain of people with addiction looks like compared to people who do not have addiction. We also do studies which we call behavior studies, where we try to understand the people behavior. For example, we want to understand why some people make some choices and how their decision-making may be impacted. Why you chose to spend half your stipend on buying cocaine or fentanyl as opposed to do something healthier for you and your family. You know, nobody wants to harm themselves.
No.
So there are actually fundamental reasons why people do so when they have addiction problems. The third wave of clinical studies we do at NIDA is toward the treatment. So once we better understand why some people develop addiction, and once we have a better understanding of how their brain is different compared to people without addiction, the question is, can we use this information to develop new treatments? And that's exactly what we do in the Intramural Research Program. For example, we have many clinical studies where we are looking at what we call neuromodulation. So these are devices such as a transcranial magnetic stimulation, which is currently approved for some disease, including for smoking and also for motor disease. And we want to understand if a transcranial magnetic stimulation may help people to reduce their consumption of drugs. And finally, other clinical studies we do are related to discovering and developing new medications. And when we do these studies, typically we do what we call, I'm going to use again some technical terms, but I'm going to explain more, double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized clinical trial.
I thought you were going to say that. That was enough.
Yeah, you go. So what does it mean? Typically, these actually are the standard design to do clinical trials by FDA, Food and Drug Administration, rules and guidelines. So double-blind means that while some people receive the real drug and some people receive the placebo, I don't know, my staff doesn't know, and the patients don't know either who is taking what. And randomized means that who is going to decide who is taking the real drug and who is taking placebo? It's actually by chance. So we have issued some mathematical system to decide who goes on the real drug and who goes on placebo. And it seems a little tricky, like why you do so, but actually that's exactly the way to go if you want to understand if a medication may work for people with addiction or actually for any other medical disease.
Now, I know this sounds like maybe a simplistic question, but I thought, well, since you were the clinical director, you would know better than anybody. What is the difference between a clinical trial and a clinical study?
Uh-huh. That's a great question as well. So clinical study is a very broad term to say that each time someone is conducting a study with humans, that's a clinical study. So it could be, for example, a study with healthy volunteers. It could be a simple descriptive study. Let's say you come to our study, we ask you some questions, we take your blood, we do what we call EKG to look at your heart. Some of the studies are also called repository, meaning that we take a lot of your blood, your urine, and we store in the freezer for future use. Some studies may be longitudinal, so we actually want to follow up you over time for many, many years. For example, right now, the NIH is conducting a gigantic, amazing effort called ABCD to follow young adults over time for many, many years. Now, when a clinical study involves an intervention, a treatment, such as, for example, a medication, such as a behavior treatment, for example, a psychological therapy, such as a neuromodulation with this device, that is what the clinical trial is. So a clinical trial is a formal clinical study where you have an intervention. It typically, that the clinical trial could be what we call open label, meaning everybody is receiving that intervention, or could be, back to the lingo I was using before, double-blind placebo control.
I hate to do this, Doctor. We have to run, but we'll come back and we'll find out the rest, and you can find out that maybe you can take part in a clinical study. That's next.
This episode of Advancing the Science on Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
We're back here on Advancing the Science of Addiction and Recovery, brought to you by the National Institute of Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. I'm your host, Jimmy Alexander, and here with the clinical director, Dr. Leggio. Now, Dr. Leggio, we were talking about the differences between a clinical trial and a clinical study, and I think you were going to the next one. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, so what I was going to say is when you have a clinical trial, you have what we call an intervention. And usually when you test an intervention, eventually what you want to do is, which we're talking before, what we call double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And that's kind of the gold standard to understand if an intervention is going to work or not in people with that specific medical disease, such as, in our case, addiction.
Now, I heard you mention smoking earlier. Now, the rate of smoking has dropped a lot over the last, let's say, 20 years. But the damage that smoking has caused and the people are still smoking, it's still a huge problem.
It is a huge problem. And, you know, as many people know, smoking is a leading cause of cardiovascular disease, smoking disease, and cancer.
Yeah. My mother, I should mention, a longtime smoker, and she passed away from strokes. And and then I had a brother-in-law who died of COPD.
Yeah.
And it's like either one of those are not good.
They're not good. Smoking is also a good example of how important it is to act at the public health level. So, you know, smoking rates have been dropping because we as a society have done some interventions to reduce, which basically tells you that from a public health standpoint, it's very important to synergize multiple parallel approaches, meaning prevention, early diagnosis, and treatment. For example, I, as a physician scientist at the NIH, I work primarily on treatments, developing new treatments for people with addiction. But it's absolutely very important also to develop the policies that may reduce the likelihood that the people develop addiction, and also to develop early intervention. Just like anything else in medicine, obesity, heart problems, cancer, prevention is key, and early diagnosis is key. I mean, think about, to make an analogy, think about if I get diagnosed with cancer without metastasis early on versus cancer with metastasis. The likelihood of survival is going to be dramatically different. So in a sense, it's very similar for addiction as well. The sooner we can identify people with addiction, and the sooner we can intervene and provide the treatment, the better it will be for the society.
Now, I've noticed and I think we all have, listening to the radio or seeing on television or reading in the newspaper, even social media, that sadly a young person in high school will lose their life because of drugs, or an older person will lose their life because of drugs. And it's one of those issues with addiction. It doesn't have an age. It doesn't. You can be rich or poor, old or young, rural or living slap dab in the middle of the city. It knows no bounds, addiction and the crisis that we have with drugs right now.
You are absolutely right. Actually, what you say, Jimmy, is actually exactly the reason why, or one of the reasons, a testament of the fact that addiction is a medical disease. You know, in the past, we as a society believed that addiction was a bad behavior, was just something that some people were doing. There were many clichés. There was a lot of stigma around. If that was really truth, you should have seen less and less addiction in some parts of our community, of our population. But in actuality, addiction, as you nicely, beautifully said, addiction is spread out all around the world and all around all populations. It doesn't matter if you're poor, rich. It doesn't matter where you live. Addiction, just like cancer, like Parkinson's disease, et cetera, may affect many people.
Now, with that, I know you're looking for people to take part in the studies and the research that you're doing at NIH. How would someone go about doing that? And are you looking for a certain type of person, a certain age group?
Right. So in general, first of all, if people want to contact us, they can call us. We actually have a direct line. It's 800-535-8254. We also have an email. It's researchstudies.nida.nih.gov. And typically, we have many clinical studies. Right now, we have more than 20 clinical studies we are conducting. So we're not looking for just one type of individual. And typically, which is really exciting in the NIH system, in the IRP, Intramural Research Program, we have a sort of a broad screening protocol, meaning that some people may call us and say, I'm very interested in being that specific study, XYZ. But some people may call us and say, I'd like to be in some of your studies. Do you have any study for me? Either way, we invite people to come to our clinic and to do this broad screening. And at the end of the screening, we sit down with them and say, okay, based on the medical information we collect from you, we think that you could be eligible for these studies. Which one or which ones you would be interested? And then, of course, if people are interested, there is a process called informed consent that they sign, and then they can be in the study. And it's very important to understand that being part of clinical research is absolutely voluntary. People sign a consent, but actually signing a consent is only the start, but not the end of what we call the consent process. When people are in our studies, we continue to inform them on a continuous basis about that's what's going to happen next. And people always have the rights to change their mind at any time and say, you know, I don't want to be in this study any longer. And that's absolutely fine.
Now, when you're looking for folks, or you're looking for folks who have a drinking problem, cigarettes, cocaine, different drugs, maybe even overeating, is that what is the umbrella of those folks you're looking for?
Right. So it's primarily people with alcohol and substance use disorder. So primarily people with alcohol, smoking, cocaine, opioids. But also we are recruiting in some of these clinical studies people without alcohol substance use disorder that also are very important. We sometimes use the term healthy controls or healthy volunteers because some of the studies we do are really meant to understand what happens in people without addiction.
With that, doctor, there are people probably listening. And maybe it's not them. Maybe it's somebody who's a loved one in their lives. How does someone know? What's the tip off that I do have a problem? It has gone to the point I can't stop this myself. I need to look and research and get help.
Right. Well, that's a wonderful question. You know, there is not one reason or one trigger. But I would say, you know, addiction as a chronic medical disease does lead to a variety of consequences, multiple levels in your body, so medical consequence, for example, in your heart, blood pressure, your liver, etc., but also psychological consequence, stress, anxiety, financial consequence, family consequence. And my strong recommendation is do not wait for all of this problems to happen to you before you seek help. If you see that something is, you know, if something is taking you away from your normal life, if there is something wrong in your health, if your doctor is telling you there is something that may be related to your alcohol drink or to your smoking, etc., be as proactive as possible and seek help. I think it's very important to say that yes, addiction is a chronic brain disease, is a chronic medical disease, but it is treatable at any stage. But seeking help from a specialist is very, very important. Just like if you discover you have a cancer and you want to seek help from an oncologist, you know, similarly, when you have an addiction problem, you want to seek help from a specialist right away.
More with Dr. Loggio coming up next.
This episode of Advancing the Science on Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
You're listening to Advancing the Science on Addiction Recovery, brought to you by the National Institute of Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institute of Health. I'm your host, Jimmy Alexander, and we're here with Dr. Loggio, the clinical director of NIDAIRP. And, doctor, we're talking about different addictions that people have. And one of the ones I think a lot of people thought went away but came back as cocaine. That, you know, and forgive this term, but you would hear people, the fashionable drugs back in like the 80s, and it wasn't fashionable, but that's what they said. Right. But it's still around and it's rampant.
It is, absolutely. And, you know, we talk a lot about the opioid pandemic, which is devastating to our society, including with fentanyl. we have been talking today with you about alcohol, which is also a leading reason why we have so many deaths and disease due to alcohol. But cocaine and stimulants, methamphetamine as well, are also dramatically affecting our society. And then the problem on top of that is that the people often use together these drugs. For example, the combination of a cocaine and alcohol is really, really harmful. And also the combination of a cocaine and fentanyl is really, really harmful. So yes, unfortunately, cocaine is still here in our society. People use often cocaine with other addictive drugs, such as opioids, fentanyl in particular, alcohol. And one challenge that's actually a very important mission of NIADA is to identify new treatments for cocaine use disorder. We have a few medications for opioid use disorder. We have a few medications for tobacco smoking. We have a few medications for alcohol use disorder, but we do not have medications for cocaine use disorder. In fact, the NIDA, including in our intramural research program in Baltimore, we're really working hard to develop new treatments for people with cocaine use disorder.
It's just so sad when you see these stories, and we've talked about it earlier, on the news or even, you know, social media seems somehow more heartbreaking when it's somebody that you know, somebody who's a relative, a loved one, somebody who maybe you went to high school or college with, and you see that their life has gone down that road, and it's just chaos. It's funny, as you're talking, my brother had schizophrenia, and it was something that was chaos.
Sure.
In his poor life, terrible. And before, it was older than I was, and it was just terrible. And when he was good, he was good. But then when he got off the meds, it just took a turn. And you always knew because you'd get the phone call at 3 a.m. You're like, oh, here we go. Yeah. And but the problem with the medication he was on, it, and you probably hear this, they feel no highs, they feel no lows. It's just here. And so he would go and start taking drugs. And he passed away right during the COVID thing of an overdose. Well, thank you very much. But in not saying that I was that I celebrated his death, it was the chaos for him was over. That I looked at it. We tried to all look at it that way. That whatever all the stuff that he went through, he wasn't living with that anymore. But I hear that quite often from a lot of folks who do deal with mental illness. That is one of the reasons why a lot of them get on drugs. Is that something that you hear about also?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of comorbidity. So between mental health and addiction, schizophrenia in particular, the comorbidity with smoking is actually gigantic. Virtually almost everybody with schizophrenia smokes cigarettes. And then on top of that, they will often seek other drugs and alcohol as well. Bipolar disorder, that's another mental health where I would say 90% of people with bipolar disorder have an alcohol problems as well. So sadly, they really go handy. And you're absolutely right that sometimes people with mental health, they will feel that by using alcohol drugs, they will help them more than the medication. But the problem is it will become a vicious cycle where actually the alcohol and addictive drugs will make your mental health worse and worse.
Now, if you meet a parent, let's say, doctor, and they said that my child has an addiction to whatever, what is the first step that you would tell them to do?
Right. And this has been happening to me. Friends who call me and say, you know, my son, my daughter, they have a problem.
You know, and this is your life's work, so
exactly.
Better to come to you.
Exactly. So the first tip I give to them is to talk with a healthcare provider. That's really important. You know, parents will often think, and rightly so, that they have to fix that problem. And it's paradoxically easier to accept that your son has, for example, cancer, because you will not think twice.
Mm-hmm.
You will go to a doctor who is a specialist on cancer oncologist to say, my son, for example, has cancer, help me. But with addiction, we often think that we can take care of that. And actually, we can't, because it's a medical disease that we really need to seek help from people who have been trained as a healthcare provider. So back to your original question, that would be my first strong advice to parents. Bring your daughter, your son, to a healthcare provider. Could be an addiction medicine doctor, could be a psychiatrist. Actually, there are many pediatricians, doctors who go, for example, to addiction medicine as a subspecialty. There are also psychiatrists who specialize in child psychiatrists. So there are physicians and clinicians in general with that specialty. And I think it's very important for parents. It's very painful. It's a struggle to accept. Like, why are you doing this? Why can't I just, quote, be on track, stay on track? But the reality is addiction is a complex medical disorder. Don't try to fix addiction yourself for you or for your kids, but seek help for people with the right training. Would you try to help your kid with diabetes by managing their diabetes yourself? No. You will go to a doctor who specializes in diabetes endocrinology. So that's the main message I give to people.
And so often you hear with drug abuse or alcohol abuse, the shaming of it, that a parent could, you know, what's wrong with you, as you just mentioned, where you shame your child or you shamed your loved one so much, then they totally almost hide all of those actions, and you have no idea what's going on because they didn't feel safe to talk to the person that you would think is the easiest person or the person who loves them the most in the world, and just because of the shaming of it. Because as you mentioned, it's a problem with the brain.
Yeah, yeah. And the shame comes from the stigma, because we as a society still struggle to appreciate it, that this is a disease of the brain, this is a medical disease, and we should really treat just like any other medical disease. You know, in the past, I mean, there's still stigma around other diseases as well, right? For example, depression. But would you say to someone with depression, what's wrong with you? Just be happy. No, that's not the solution. You tell people, seek help from a physician, from a healthcare provider, from a counselor. So that's the main challenge that we as a society have in front of us, eliminating stigma so that everybody with addiction may actually seek help and access treatment. But that shame that you were mentioning, that's a huge challenge we have in our society. Because of that shame, people will not seek treatment. And because of the stigma around addiction, we don't do enough regarding training healthcare providers in how to treat addiction.
With that, I know so many families who deal with this and send their children to, you know, camps or rehab and those, you know, outward bounds type things. And I know it's really, really incredibly expensive. And a lot of families have lost everything trying to make sure that the person that's battling that issue within their family finds the help that they need. And that's why you guys are doing such a great job at the National Institute of Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, which is part of the National Institute of Health. And I know if you're wanting to take part in the clinical trial or study, you can go to researchstudies.nida.com or call 1-800-535-8254. Again, that's 1-800-535-8254.
This episode of Advancing the Science on Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.
Thanks for spending part of your day with us here on Advancing the Science of Addiction and Recovery, brought to you by the National Institute of Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institute of Health. We're here with Clinical Director Dr. Leggio. And Dr. Leggio, I know you guys are doing incredible work, but how many investigators do you have working with you? And how many studies do you have currently going on? I think you mentioned it already.
Right. So in terms of investigators in the NIDA Intramural Research Program in Baltimore, we are 26 investigators, now including myself. Some of them do primarily basic science, so meaning research in the bench, research with animal models of addiction, such as mice and rats. And some investigators, including myself, precisely 6 out of 26, we do clinical research. So research with patients and research with volunteers in the field of addiction. And across the whole clinical portfolio of the Intramural Research Program, we have around 20 clinical studies right now which are active, and we are actively enrolling participants to be in our studies.
Now, when you started down this path as a career, what would you say has changed most since you started till today?
Oh, that's a wonderful question, Jimmy. I think a lot has been changing. First of all, you know, I've been in this field now for more than 20 years. First of all, we do have a better understanding of addiction. We do have a better understanding of the reasons in the brain why some people develop and maintain addiction. I would say, do we fully understand that? No, we don't. There's still a lot of work to do. But definitely in the past 2 decades, I have seen myself how our knowledge, our neuroscience knowledge, has been growing a lot. And the second is that we also now better understand that even if addiction is a brain disease, actually the brain does not work in isolation. Actually, here, I touch something very close to my heart because my specific program as an investigator at the NIH, so not as the clinical director for all NIDA, but my own program as investigator, we specifically focus on that. We basically pose the question, how is the brain talking with the rest of the body? And so my team of students, fellows, and staff, we do a lot of research in understanding how, for example, the gut talks with the brain and how the heart talks with the brain. Now, what do we do so? You could say, Lorenzo, you've just been talking here for 50 minutes about addiction being a brain disease. And now, wait, you're bringing the gut, the heart, I'm lost.
Well, first of all, we'd never call you Lorenzo. I'd call you doctor because you went to a lot of years in school to be called doctor. So I would never call your first name.
But it's okay. You actually can call me Lorenzo. But so the idea is, you know, we take a sort of whole approach. Look at the whole body. And we pose the question, if the brain talks with the gut and vice versa, maybe that knowledge could be important for us to better understand addiction. Actually, if you think, Jimmy, about our daily life, we sometimes say, hey, go with your gut. Okay, gut feelings. And guess what? I mean, if I'm upset with a friend of mine, I feel this pain in the middle of my stomach, right? These anecdotal things actually are reflecting a lot of a gain in knowledge in the past 20 years. We have better understood that our body, including the gut and the heart, are in constant communication with the brain. That's what we call technically gut-brain axis, heart-brain axis. And why is that important? Well, it's important because now what my team and other teams also are working on is to better understand these gut-brain connections. And by doing so, we hope to better understand addiction and develop new treatments for addiction. Actually, that's exactly what we are doing right now. To give an example, we are studying some hormones in our body that come from our gut. But we believe that these gut hormones, that's how we call, they communicate with the brain. They talk with the brain. And we believe that by working on these hormones, we may develop new treatments for addiction. And a few decades ago, before I jumped to this field, I think there was a way much less appreciation of all these connections and the complexity of how addiction is really interjecting not only with the brain, but also with the whole body.
Why did you go into this field?
That's a question that we may need half a day, but I will try to be as short as possible. So before going to medical school, actually, I lost my grandfather because of stomach cancer. And my father, who is still alive, turning 90 years old in a few months, he had colon cancer. And I was actually, as a kid, very passionate about biology. In fact, I think I was thinking to pursue a PhD. But then having to this, serious medical problems in my family, this was really a shift in my priorities. So I went to medical school to become a cancer doctor. But of course, I didn't become an oncologist. So then during medical school, I was really fascinated by biochemistry and how the liver actually does a lot of a process in our body. And guess what? One of the main reasons why people develop liver disease is alcohol. So that led me to think more about, I was seeing a lot of patients with alcohol liver disease. And I was puzzled by the idea that these people have a liver problem to do alcohol. But the reason why they were damaging their liver was because of the addiction underlining the problematic alcohol use. So then I made a third shift from the liver to the brain to really try to better understand addiction. And so in a sense, if you think it was almost like a full cycle in my life, because at the end, alcohol is a leading cause of liver disease. Alcohol and drugs, such as smoking, are leading causes or leading risk factors for cancer. So in a sense, I didn't become an oncologist. I didn't become a hepatologist or a doctor treating liver disease. But as I became an addiction physician scientist, now I'm very, very engaged, passionate about the possibility that I can contribute to the society by trying to help it to reduce the damage that addiction does to families and patients, including what we call organ damage, meaning damage to your liver, damage to your heart, increasing your risk of developing cancer, et cetera, et cetera. So it was not a straight line, if you will, in my career. There were some unpredictable changes I made. And if you ask me, would you go back and do exactly what I did? I would say absolutely yes. You know, we have students in our program. I should say one of the missions of the NIH IRP Intramural Research Program is a training. Actually, training is a significant, important mission. We bring students, meaning post-bac students, and we train them. And many of them want to go to medical school, so we help them to succeed to go into medical school or to graduate school or to clinical psychologist. And sometimes some of my students come to me and say, okay, Lorenzo, that's my plan. I want to go to medical school, then I want to go to psychiatrist, and then I want to subspecialize in addiction psychiatry. I said, this is wonderful. But that said, be always open-minded. I went to medical school for one goal, and I went completely a different route. It has been just fascinating and wonderful to change your life based on how your gut Well, thank you, too.
Well, I'm sure now that you're a first-time father, right? And
I am.
That must even be more meaningful, knowing that what you and everyone there at NIH is doing is helping change the world and help change the lives of many, many people into the future.
You're absolutely right. I mean, so I've been now a father for 4.5 months, so I'm still very junior. I'm still in training. But you're right, it has been changing a lot my perspective, meaning that if anything, I have now firsthand appreciation of how important it is to try to live, you know, one day I will die. And I really hope I will leave this planet in a better shape on how people can face challenges, including addiction.
Well, that is the goal in life, right? To leave the earth better off than when you arrived.
Yeah.
There is one thing that's happened recently that I wanted your opinion on, Doctor, is the loosening of marijuana laws. You know, years ago, you know, you had to know somebody who knew somebody, and now, you know, it's sold on so many different corners. Do you think that is a good thing or a bad thing that it's so readily available legally?
I would say it's complicated. Actually, if you go to the NIDA website, there is a lot of information about cannabis. And I think what we want to do as a scientific community is to really pay close attention to how legalization is changing the landscape. We want to definitely pay close attention to how this change may lead to change in how people are using cannabis. And also we want to pay attention to how, for some people, cannabis or some of the science related to cannabis may help us to better understand addiction. In a sense, you know, our mission as NIH is not to establish a policy, but what we do is to provide evidence-based science that may inform policy. And so your question is critical, and I would say it's a complex topic, and definitely we at the NIDA are paying very close attention and following the trends, even from an epidemiology standpoint, very, very closely, and supporting research that may help NIDA to provide the best evidence-based science to inform future policy.
Well, thank you very much today. It was so nice talking to you. Congratulations on your new baby. And thank you for spending part of your day with us here on Advancing the Science on Addiction and Recovery, which is brought to you by the National Institute of Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Join us next time for another insightful episode. Until then, stay informed and take care.
This episode of Advancing the Science on Addiction is brought to you by the National Institute on Drug Abuse Intramural Research Program, part of the National Institutes of Health. Learn more about clinical trials and studies and how you can participate at researchstudies.nida.nih.gov or call 1-800-535-8254. The National Institute on Drug Abuse, advancing addiction science for 50 years.